So I was at first a bit reluctant to do the two things at once, because when you are in the organization mood, it's kind of different. It's a different experience. And but let me try to do this. And I'd like to start with what Mick said on the first day, and inhabiting this curious contradiction of being a social theorist and ethnographer. So I'm not really actually solving the contradiction, but my assignment for today is to show you how I inhabit this this dual think, and what is social theory to me. It's essentially something that goes with a set of problems. So I have a number of problems, also, you know, personal problems, as everybody has these kind of things. But one of these problems is the one I would like to share with you today. A little bit concerns public life, public space, and one of these problems. It's the formulation is very simple, and is what is social life. It's one of these amusing problems, but the question is not really important. What's important is the answer, which I don't have, and so that's probably why I have something to say today, just to explain why I don't have the answer. And as Woody Allen says, I've fixed all the small details, and now if I can cope with a big question, that would be fine. Certain visibility of public space. To say that I'm always a bit reluctant to use this term public space, because we don't really know what public space is. So what I would like to focus on is a little bit what is. This is one of my point. What is precisely public in public space? Because we inherit all sorts of definitions, legal definitions, of course, political definitions, if you want, of public space is. But as ethnographers and as social scientists, I have to sort of, I think, sort of bracket this label and try to see what is. Yesterday we had this thing, and many of us had, we just went out and sat in a square and asked, puzzling about, hey, Mimmo, Mitico. Another fundamental contribution from the ethnographic crew. Is it really a public space here? What is it, and what are the other things that are around? So I would like to start with a series of approximations of this experience. That's why it speaks a little bit to the title of our summer school edition, the experience of fieldwork. This young fellow here is Franz Kafka, the writer, which you are familiar with, and the guy on the left is his best friend, Max Brod, also known as the traitor, because he betrayed Kafka's legacy and Kafka's request to destroy all his writings. And so we owe a Kafka to Brod, basically. We know Kafka thanks to this betrayal of Brod. But this is interesting because here they are almost naked, and they are on a bath establishment, something like that, probably on the Danube. And Kafka speaks a lot, especially in the letter to his father, about this experience of being, because he was really thin and was a kind of shy and was kind of obsessed with his own thinness, speaks a lot about the disgraceful feeling of showing himself in public. And then in another place, he writes that it was thanks to this experience of going half naked on the beach that he could precisely overcome this terrible shame. And this is one of the entryway to the experience of the public, right? This idea of existing in the gaze of the other. And this, which is a terrible, terrible experience in many cases, not, uncomfortable experience, right? In many cases. So, what does this, this others who look at us do to us, right? This kind of not simply visual relationship, but really mostly a haptic relationship with the other. So when the gaze turns into really something physical, right? It's just like something that grasps us. So this idea that the public exists as a domain of visibility. So here we have one of the entry points into this puzzle of public space, of public experience. And in many cases, this is really the experience also that we have as ethnographers, like doing fieldwork, that there is a complex interplay of gazes, and there is a complex interplay of forces. Gazes are not simply geometrical things. It's really like something that do things, that make things happen. It's profoundly, if I may say, affective. But these affections that I know Mick is a bit reluctant to use this terminology because it sounds fashionable and it seems that it doesn't say anything, but maybe what it says is that really this relationship really decompose us, they decompose and recompose us, and this is one of the things that Kafka went through, this idea of shame. Another thing, this is a drawing, so I hope Mick would be a little bit excited more than with the picture. It's a drawing from a famous painter from the late 19th, early 20th century. He is also the Gerald H. Thayer, and he is the son of another painter, Abbot H. Thayer. And these two guys, the father and the son, basically went on with this elaboration of camouflage and animal concealment and mimicry. And they are famous, especially not in the academia, but especially outside, because they got a contract for the U.S. Army to camouflage battleships during the First World War. So this is the history of animal camouflage. So it's part of the military history of the 20th century. And what happened is that basically they went to a series of puzzles by wondering what happens when animals adopt this concealing coloration. They call it concealing coloration in the animal kingdom. Animals can do it. Humans also do it. We also do it. We do a lot of things just as animals do. And in the first picture up above, you see the same snake as in the pictures below. But what is different? It's actually, as you can imagine, the environment. So this is a strategy of visibility and invisibilization. And in general, I try to make this distinction, a very basic one, between an object and an environment. And an object is something that stands before us, and so we can become subjects because we have this object, right? So this dual relationship, and it's frontal kind of relationship. We are in front of the object. But what are the boundaries, what are the limits of the object when the object kind of explodes, or when the object has this kind of twilight existence? It tends to escape towards the environment. And the environment is what we cannot stand really in front of it, but rather it surrounds us. So it's all around us. And as the object disappears, it's kind of environmentalizes itself. So it it disappears. Hmm? There is this strange relationship. It's no longer an object. Hmm? There's a nice essay by Roger Caillois, one of these fellows from the Collège de Sociologie in the late 1930s in Paris, strongly associated with Bataille, which has been evoked, and with Michel Leiris. And Caillois is probably one of the strangest of this group. Maybe not the most radical, Bataille was definitely the most radical one, but Caillois went on in a series of strange exercises and ended up writing books on stones. But originally it was really about this, and there's this essay from, I think, 1936. The years are ominous because it's the years just before the Second World War, and these guys were really observing the rise of Nazi in Germany, and how this was really creating a whole new world. And Caillois wrote this essay called Mimicry and Legendary Psychasthenia. Now it requires a little bit of explanation. Psychasthenia is a term that Caillois draws from Pierre Janet, the psychologist at the end of the 19th century, same age as Freud, basically. Both were students with Charcot at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, and Janet became famous for this classification of psychic disturbances. He had basically two branches, which is not what became the mainstream version, but his two branches were hysteria on the one hand and psychasthenia on the other. So psychasthenia is when the subject, the psychological subject, has a kind of hardship, can no longer really draw the boundaries of himself or herself. So it has really difficulties with establishing, this is really essential for understanding social life, how do we manage distances between ourselves and the others, and how these distances become kind of critical at a certain point, and when these distances collapse. And we had a little bit of it in the Belfonte passage that Nick showed us, when he says when the legitimate distances, it crossed the legitimate distance because it touched me. This is the theme of honor, when honor, it means really coming too close, right? And then when you come physically too close to the other, you interfere with the legitimate sphere, the personal sphere. Zimmer also speaks a lot about this sphere that surrounds us, and all of the Goffmanian tradition in the study of social interaction has to do with this critical distances management, right? Mimicry has something to do with that, because it's a way in which this critical distance is, kind of tricked upon. So there's a way of playing a trick with this domain of the which is no longer, I would say, just simply a visibility management, but really something deeper. I would say it's inscribed in the constitution of the visible as really the if I may say, the substance of this of the social. This is something that has to do with the difficulty, right, of and Caillois really speaks really of animal mimicry as a kind of luxury in the natural world, whereby really it's something that has it's even beyond the functional. It's not just really concealing from either a prey or what's the opposite, the hunter, right? The someone who, it's not just a matter of disappearing from your, sorry, say it again?
Predator.
Yeah, the predator or the prey, right? So some of this relationship, but it's really something that is a luxury, something that goes beyond this, and it's the temptation. Caillois says a beautiful sentence, is the temptation to become similar. Not similar to this and that, but really to become similar. It's very close to something Walter Benjamin writes in his essay on mimicry, the temptation to pass to the environment, right? To us on the outside of ourselves. Really strange, uncanny thing. Another entry point is perhaps more familiar to us. It goes back to this our urban preoccupation. This is a picture I took in Trento, and it's one of these huge urban renewal in progress. I know some of you, especially with Nick and Christina, will be studying this area. This is precisely before what you're going to see these days. It was completely fenced and abandoned. But technically speaking, it was still public space, right? So what is this? It has to do really with accessibility, right? We tend to assume that public space is accessible, is something we can enter. But in many cases, the paradox that came to my mind when I was walking around these areas and in transition, I would say, was that really nobody was there, and simultaneously everybody wrote and spoke and commented about the future of this space, right? So it's absent, but it's present, right? Nobody's there, nobody, unless perhaps we know the kind of invisible, illegitimate presences, the homeless and the wildlife and all sorts of underground figures and underground urban inhabitants, but still it's big in the media. It's big in the media. So this is again something. It should be something. It should be accessible, but maybe it's not really accessed. And yet, everybody speaks about it. The city and the media, I have to say, the good thing is that there is no real opposition between these two. And I think Nick yesterday gave us really this thing in the fullest sense, because actually this is, as I have to say this to also to appease the ghost of Gabriel Tarde, because Gabriel Tarde was perhaps, again, in the late 19th century, one of the first to show that he started with joining this huge debate about urban crowds and the riotous urban crowds. So this idea that really there is this you know, super packed and super dense experience with our cities. The choc de métropole, the shock of the urban life, also very powerful in Georg Simmel, and in all that generation, really the late 19th century generation. The city is the place for urban shocks, for extreme excitement and hyperesthesia, and on the other hand, Tarde wrote this fundamental little book, L'Opinion à la Foule, The Opinion and the Crowd, where he says really there is this other thing which is the companion to the crowd, and he calls that they public. They public in the sense of the audience, the audience of the readers of a journal, and this is another thing. So in many cases, the curious visibility of public space is that it's not really the place itself that's visible, so much as, you know, the discourse about it. The discourse about this, and of course the fame of these spaces. That's why when, as ethnographers, we go in a disadvantaged neighborhood or in a very peripheral yet iconic area, such as could be Scampia, for instance, we realize that there is this strange disconnecting feeling, because the whole world knows about this place, and then you go there and it's not as it has been, of course, represented, but still the people who live there are affected by this discourse, right? So still this strange thing. Then I'd like just to add another entry point. Maybe it's, you know, we are trying to make a few trails into this puzzle. The Jamaican sound system tradition. I took this picture, of course, because I love the Jamaican sound system. Or I should better say sound system, as the Jamaicans. It has to do with this tradition of going around with a massive sound system and speakers and you know, kicking music, and most of the you know, the party tradition, my generation in the 1990s, you know, it's really an heritage of that thing when just, you know, well, we started with this in Bologna in the 1990s, we started with this so-called street parades and taken from Berlin, the Love Parade in Berlin and stuff. But the original version is this one when you add these DJs, mythical figures such as Lee Scratch Perry and these guys, and you know, they were really doing the original thing, and it has to do with this address. So it's really this vector from really. Here we go, really from the center to the periphery, really. It's really this explosive thing. There is something explosive about public space and public domain, if you want, because there is really this disruptive move. Mm. There's no peaceful public space. I want to go beyond this ironic or peaceful imagery that the public... domain, the public space that accommodates really diversities, and there is this movement which is really addressing super. And again, it's very effective in the Kafkian sense, because I could have also put a picture of a tag, really, of a graffiti tag, because it elicits very much the same reaction, right? It's perceived as excessive, as outrageous, as something that it's one of the quintessential manifestation of urban disorder, right? It's something that it's too much, really. It's too much. It's and graffiti haters really can become really obsessive about it. This beautiful short story from a guy here in Trento who was such a graffiti hater that basically he went to this and he did really incredible. It's incredible what it did. It was a man in his 50s, you know, and he hated these kids doing graffiti. So he went on each single tag and he wrote like sfigato on each single tag, you know. So it was really writing over graffiti.
Just like sfigato.
Yes, loser, like sucker, you know, sucker. And he wrote with this. So, but he was still, you know, doing. You cannot. He's a writer in it, you know, on his own accord. So you cannot really, you know, that's. It's a positive for which there's no negative, right? So because if you do something, you don't, you know, detract from what is there. You just add another layer to the thing. So, you know, it's so this is a very, very intense thing. So these surface games, which goes with the story of the camouflage, also it's a place where meaning is created and where meaning is also deceitful in a way. It can also create misunderstanding, not only meaning but also misunderstandings. This is another picture from this quick tour of curious things about. It's an old venerable Neapolitan tradition which has been recently revived in a very gentrified/hipster context. And in fact, this is not Naples; it's Milan, and it's the famous pending or suspended coffee tradition, where it's a philanthropic tradition from the 19th century, where the bourgeois would go to the coffee shop with the coffee house, and they would pay for two coffees and drink just one and leave one for the poor, and so the poor would then went from coffee to coffee and asking, is there any paid or prepaid coffee for me? But what is interesting is that about this, I take it as an instance of the kind of also impersonal dimension of the public domain. There is something impersonal. There's a similar scene that is told by Walter Benjamin concerns Paris, and it describes the way in which bus fares were paid to the bus driver in Paris, because the early buses were so overcrowded that you couldn't really possibly reach the. So what happened was that the guy would take out the money for for the ticket, and then the money would be passed on to the bus driver, and then the ticket would come all the way back to the original. So this thing, you know, and you know, we could also, it's, the scene is impressive, but it's, you could also take out the bus, take out the bus fare and the bus ticket, and take just money itself. It's completely, it's public because it's completely impersonal. It's completely, you know, there's, you know, everybody can have it, everybody can touch it, and it's not, there's no particular association with any of your deep emotions, right? Well, it touches very deeply when it comes to money, but it's at the same time, it's just, you know, there's no, so what does it mean? How is it related to the puzzle of the public domain, this thing that it's around, it circulates, and it carries this vector which I call, following Deleuze, of course, I call deterritorialization, right? There's this vector of away from territories. There's this vector of being kind of disembedding move. There's this disembedding move. You can have the public domain only once you have this powerful disembedding strategy or disembedding thing. Another thing, just to show that I'm not afraid of statistics, is this, because it's very difficult to make an ethnography of what a nation think. But here we have the famous Greek referendum from July 2015, and there is a yes and a no, right? And it's very rarely you reach this kind of ratio between the yes and the no, because in many cases in our Western democracies it's really 50.3 to 50.4, right? So this is something that speaks a lot about the public domain. I think it was Mick again on the first day he mentioned this vociferous, this quarreling thing, this. It's as if, and this again, it's Gabriel Tarr, really. Gabriel Tarr says, publics work like this, tend to work like this. There's an issue, and here the issue is pretty clear. There's the question that was posed to the referendum, and there's a split. Wherever you have this thing, so this again speaks about the public domain. There's this, you know, this thing which you can't escape, just in front of everybody's eyes, and the, you know, it cuts in two. Right, and there are this tremendous of divergence, right, of opinions, right? It's also there is the another nice idea that comes from Elias Canetti, which is the idea of the double crowd. You have a double crowd when you actually have a crowd which is made of two crowds, and they look at each other. Typically, football match, you know, hooligans on the one side, hooligans on the other, and the moderates in between. But they really look at each other, right? And the stadium is really the architecture that keeps the double crowd, because it allows you to really look at each other and, you know that you are there, and everybody has got his own flag. I could also taken many, many pictures of the yes versus no in, and everybody's waving their flag, and so this is another entry point into this curious thing of the public domain. We have an issue, and it's a common issue, but we have two radically diverging opinions, and then we go on discussing and articulating these, and we discover that the opposition is not so sharp and stark, but certainly yes and no is sharp and stark. Another thing I would like to draw your attention to is another drawing from great painter Paul Klee. This is a drawing called Urban Landscape, and it's a drawing in which there are it's a beautiful vision. It's about the time 1920 when Paul Klee wrote this short essay called The Creative Confession. And it speaks about the fact that art does not repeat the visible. Art makes visible, right? Makes visible. And again, it's curious that there, just as in the definition by Caillois, becoming similar, not to this or that, but becoming similar, and Paul Klee again says, becoming art makes visible, and the object again is lacking, really, because really, what is the object of this becoming visible, right? What is the object? It's really curious. But here there is another thing I'd like to draw your attention to, and it's this connectivity of the city, of the urban as a public domain, right? Everything seems to be connected in some way to another. So there is this deterritorializing effect, as well as this connective effect, right? So there is this deterritorialization, which I'd like to go on a little bit farther away, but there is this incredibly connect. It's dispersed, it's kind of splintered, it's kind of fragmentary, and at the same time it keeps things moving. That is why the history of the public domain or public space, it's also the history of governance, right? And Michel Foucault, in his courses at the Collège de France, spoke extensively about the history of a very curious institution, the police. And the originally, the police was not such a circumscribed enterprise that we associate today with, especially in Italy, with the blue car and the cops. But it was really the idea of, you know, taking care of a whole environment, stands in opposition to discipline. Discipline, it points to our single individualities, and we have to self-discipline ourselves. But the police really take care of something that moves around. It cannot be localized. It's always it's like an orbit. It's just roaming around. So you remember the short story by Edgar Allan Poe, the Man of the Crowd, 1840, where at a certain point the narrator sits in a cafe and sees this stream of crowds going through the streets of London, and there is one peculiar man that attracts his attention. He doesn't know why, this man, but he starts following him. He decides to understand where is he going. And he follows this man through streets and contacts. And this man never stops, actually. It's incredible. He is a homeless. He finds at the end of the night, really, when the crowd has dissolved and it has gone into a completely different dimension, almost, you know, deranged kind of feeling, you know, the kind of Edgar Allan Poe masterful description of these creepy situations, and he goes into this really underground of the city, the underbelly of city space. You know, you can imagine the urban poverty in London in the 1840s, and then he resurrects. He goes back into the crowd of the next day, so he never stops. Really, he is really the public man. If such a creature exists, it's just like a cosmonaut. It's constantly going around, and the situationists in Paris in the 1950s did something really similar. This is a famous cut-up from Guy Debord called "The Naked City" from a 1948 movie by the same name, "The Naked City," which is a black and white movie about murder in the city, and this in a hotel. You can imagine this kind of sordid atmosphere. The situation is where this group of radical artists, most of them with an established criminal record, and they were what they did actually was walking. Basically, they were walking around the city. They were drawing this idea from the surrealists, actually, from the. In the first journal of the situation is the International, they feature an article which is called "The Bitter Victory of Surrealism," where they say surrealism defeated itself, and now it's time to do something different. But really, they did a lot of things in common with the surrealists, and they roamed around, and they, you know, they had not much money to pay for either cabs or and then in Paris the metro is famous for stopping very early, and Le Dernier Métro, it's a movie by François Truffaut. And so they walked the boulevard where their main, you know, directions, and again this deterritorializing vector and this dispersal of the public space, this thing was an exercise to probe the city according to their vision. This should have been psychogeography, not simply geography, but a geography that would have been applied and applied exercise to really feel the differences of ambiences, feel the differences of situations, feel the differences of energies and undercurrents of within the city. And here you can see also the city is cut up into different blocks, but these do not correspond to any official definition, right? Because the city, again, it's in itself governed and administered, and it's cut up into districts and stuff. But they refused, of course, the official definition of these. Instead, they said there are boundaries, certainly there are boundaries, but they come from bottom up. It's for us to find out these boundaries. It's curious. It resounds a little bit. It resonates a little bit with the notion of with the early Chicago school notion of natural areas, right? For these areas that emerge by the type of social life that's going on there. This is another image from this same tradition. The idea was pretty much to Constant, died a few years ago, he was an architect, right? So his long-term project was called New Babylon, and New Babylon was the idea of a city which would have keep changing constantly, and the dwellers of the city would have had the possibility of constantly reshaping the city. So the very physical infrastructure of the city was to be mobile. It was to be constantly rearranged by the needs and the desires, constant, as well as Raoul van Eygem wrote extensively about this idea of desiring, desire, and how does desire share desire, circulating desire, make up the city. And Constant was really working on how to make it this really feasible. You can see the city is floating. It's a city that's not attached to the ground. So this idea of, you know, moving in the air also facilitates the idea of constantly rearranging things. And most of the inspiration was really coming from the Roma people, because the situation is the international was created in was actually the formal act of birth is in a small village in Italy, Cosio da Roscia, where one of these guys, Pino Galizio, the painter, had a small lot of land which he had inherited from his parents, and since he wasn't interested in this plot of land, he basically gave it to Roma group, and they occupied it. They were living there, and so the Situationists in 1957 they were going to study how this way of living completely different from the established 1950s kind of atmosphere, 1950s very kind of conservative repressive atmosphere. We're living so a much more fluid way of occupying space, and a completely different way of there is a heritage drawing from the Situationist, a lot of post-Situationist experiences. I just want to talk a little bit about this Stalker / Osservatorio Nomade group from the early 1990s. Was born during the La Pantera movement with the student movement. What they did was really doing exercises in urban reconnaissance and walking around the city. So what you see there as a globe is in fact the city of Rome, and the golden parts are the built city, and the bluish parts are the unbuilt city. And the white path is the tour of Rome that they did in 1995. And on the right side you see some pictures from this tour. It lasted a couple of weeks, and they were walking within the interstices, in the terrain vague of the metropolis. So just to find out that there is a completely different picture of the city, and there's a completely different experience of what might be. All these places were kind of abandoned, but not quite definitely. I mean, there were a lot of, you know, they could meet shepherds with flocks, and they could meet homeless people, refugees, and they could meet hikers. They could meet all sorts of populations which were pretty much deterritorialized, right? Not living in the what the French call the cadre bâti, not living in the built environment, but just inhabiting the city in a different way. The terrible name stalker comes from, which resonates badly to many of us, because the stalker is someone who stalks you. But the terrible name comes from a movie, from an Andrei Tarkovsky's movie by the same name in the late 1970s, which the original Italian avant-garde group hadn't seen, hadn't watched already when they did the Rome exercise. They only watched it afterwards. But the story is really similar. It's a very strange story about it's a science fiction movie. It was also sold as a horror movie, but it's strange because it's a story of an exploration into a strange terrain vague called the Zone, where completely abandoned, and after an unknown event which has affected it, and a number of three strange guys look for a guide, and the guide is the stalker, so-called stalker. Really, we could call him really also a passeur. Actually, he is a passeur that enables these three urban ethnographers, these three explorers, to go into this unnamed zone, and which is pretty much a ruined and abandoned place. And also here, there's another dimension to it. It's probably not something that is really no longer belonging to the public domain, but it belongs rather to something more hidden that contradistinguish every territory. There is an intensive thing somewhere there. There's an intensive force which characterizes every territory. There's a secret place. There's a birthplace, right? And these guys are looking for the space, but they're really looking for themselves, right? So one is a writer, another is a philosopher, and I don't remember which one is the third, maybe an artist. And by doing this exploration, they are also looking for themselves. So there is this strange thing, and the passeur actually tells the zone at every minute, the zone is just like as we make it, right? As we make it. But going back to this urban thing, there are all sorts of strange places where the notion of publicness can be really tested, right? The idea of public space as being the public sphere, especially in the Habermasian tradition, as being this place of public discourse, public discussion and deliberation, is completely betrayed when it comes to these interstitial areas, these strange places, which in the Chicago urban ethnography tradition would have been called the zones in transition, the undefined, the unbuilt, the underdefined in a way. And Eugène Auger is one of these classic photographers in Paris. In between 1899 and 1913, just before the First World War, he went around Paris, just outside the city of Paris, in the so-called zone. just like in Tarkovsky's movie, this is called the zone. And it's a technical definition from urban planning, zona non edificandi, which means it's a place which, again, it's a governance place. According to the central planning institution, this should have been left empty. Deliberately left empty. And it's a regulation that goes back to the 17th century. It's a very old regulation aimed to protect the city from a military point of view, with the urban walls surrounding Paris, which is more or less where the autoroute runs now, is a protective, is a kind of immunitary system for the city. It's kind of a protected area, but in order to be really safe, you need not only to have the wall, but to have an horizontal distance, the ramparts, the outer ramparts of the city, which prevent the artillery from the enemies to come too close. This zona non edificandi was to remain empty. But it was never empty, of course. It was filled with all sorts of functions and urban outcast population, first wave immigrants to the city were living there, right? So these are the population known as the zonier, the people who inhabited the zone. I put a few pictures because they are beautiful and they give you the idea of how the really a first class metropolis in one of the most advanced and industrial European countries, France, Paris, looked like just before at the end the First World War. Really, not long ago. Really, just less than a century ago. So really, these were the people. Living in vans, right? Living in mobile homes. Maggie, who's amongst that, is mobile homes. Really, we have that. And you can also see by one of these other pictures, you see vaniglia e cioccolato. It means that basically this is an Italian immigrant, and he is making his life in the city, right? So every day he pushes the cart, the ice cream cart, down to the city center, but he cannot afford leaving the city, so he has to go back in this no man's land, right, in this settlement. The formal and the informal city coexist, right? There's a precise functional relationship, right? This is how it looks like today. It's terrible. It was the picture I took in 2010, and it's the highway of Paris, right? It's completely different. And it's, again, about urban memories. It's completely lost, right? There's nothing there which could be associated with that tradition. Moving closer to where we live, this illegal unwanted population is still there in a way. This is Gianni Berengo Gardin, and these are it's a Sinti camp. It's a Sinti camp here in Trento. In the 1980s, it's very interesting, very fascinating set of pictures that tells a lot about this community. And again, we took with my students pictures of similar camps here in very close to where we're gonna go this afternoon. So there's a strong tradition to that. I skip a few pictures because I just want to go to the graffiti issue, which would be my conclusive thing. I became interested in graffiti and what Brassai used to call the bastard art of ill-famed streets, right? Especially with many tradition in graffiti and what is now called post-graffiti or street art, and just want to show you this. Beautiful piece of early street art by an artist I'm a bit in contact with, John Fechner. He started using what is nowadays famous for being the Banksy, really Banksy language, the stencil, right? The stencil. So you see there are many ways into this, but for graffiti writers or graphers, the thing is, the experience has always been an experience of being on the margin of the legality, if not straightforwardly into illegality, right? Bad experiences with the police are typical for graffiti writers. This is a convention. Simultaneously, though, what is interesting, and I would like to conclude my reflection on the visibility of public space with this, the measures of public are changing, and the measures are also a way to create value out of places, so and value out of things that are done into places, into social practice. So the values, the measures are changing, and as you know, graffiti is caught into what I call a divergent synthesis, right? Divergent synthesis is a paradoxical movement whereby, you know, it's a synthesis, seems to be something that goes together. Divergence is something that diverges. And the divergent synthesis of graffiti is that on the one hand, you still have this idea that graffiti detracts value from places. It's criminal. It's a manifestation of urban disorder, as I said. It's excessive. It's this war on graffiti kind of framework thing. So graffiti is taken into that, but simultaneously graffiti is taken into it's a completely different story. It's no longer value detracting, but a value conferring thing, thanks to the proliferation of these type of things. In 2008 we started organizing this thing, this type of event with street art and street art things, and we started painting and having artists to paint. We were actually doing just a black thing, but with the real artist did the graffiti, right? So for us, but you know, as graffiti has been increasingly valorized and accepted into the urban narrative and the official urban narrative, it's increasingly unclear what's going on with the graffiti or post graffiti thing, and so there is this curious piece of declaration by Banksy. Just to start from the top, right? And he says, it's very interesting, and it's one of these pieces of writing which is so smart that, you know, when you read it, you want to read it again. The people who run our cities don't understand graffiti because they think nothing has a right to exist unless it makes a profit, which makes their opinion worthless. They say graffiti frightens people and is symbolic of the decline in society. But graffiti is only dangerous in the mind of three types of people: politicians, advertising executives, and graffiti writers. The people who truly deface our neighborhoods are the companies that scroll the giant slogans across buildings and buses, trying to make us feel inadequate unless we buy their stuff. They expect to be able to shout out their message in your face from every available surface, but you're never allowed to answer back. Well, they started this fight, and the wall is the weapon of choice to eat them back. Some people become cops because they want to make the world a better place. Some people become vandals because they want to make the world a better looking place. Right, this is the story. It's so smart and perfect that, you know, it's the kind of thing that when you read it, you will say, yeah, it's great, it's great. But then, I mean, if you start reading again, there are so many things, you know, so many strange things in it. Just to start, you know, some kind of verbal analysis, because I'm very sensitive to what Nick said yesterday, that there are some words which are really like, you know, these sliding doors, you know, which you think you have the thing, but then it's very, it can be it can play its trick on you. Because what it's saying is basically that, with a lot of funny, you know, things, is that there's a fight going on. And this is quintessential to public space, right? There's a fight. And the fight takes place in the domain of the visible, in the domain of the visible. And there are different actors who act upon the visible, who act upon these visible surfaces. The domain of the visible I've talked about with thanks to Kaiwa and mimicry. And it says there are also conflicting interests, and the actors are really here quite clearly identified with three types of actors. Politicians, moral entrepreneurs, if you want, advertising executives, so people from the advertisement, and graffiti writers. The initial framework really reads like the broken window thing. It really lets you understand also a little bit about the background of Banksy. You know, they're probably old, but you know, anything but really, you know, they know what they talk about, right? So this narrative is the first narrative mentioned, is the idea that graffiti is something that scares people, and it's vandalic, it's an illicit appropriation of public space. You know, it's this idea that it's a manifestation of urban disorder, right? And also Banksy is saying something more. He says they think so, politicians want to say that, want to scare people because they want to cash their votes, and in doing so they ally themselves with advertisement. So there's this perverse alliance between people who run our cities and people who make cash with our cities, and these are the advertisement agencies, because they are just like the Jamaican sound system. They broadcast their messages, and so they expect to be able to shout their messages in your face. This is Baudrillard. It's what Baudrillard used to write in the 1970s. The media are word without answer. The media, the mass media, the broadcast media. The old famous metaphor that you're constantly, you are bombed by the mass media messages, right? And you can't speak back. But he says, and he's come here, I think, graffiti writers really want to speak back. Speak back. It's a kind of very, very exciting things. But the thing is that in the meanwhile, between 2005 and probably even earlier, the equation no longer holds. Some of the premises really are changed. Some of the elements in this equation have changed. Especially because, as I said, as we started with, the paradox is that on the one hand, what Banksy is saying is that everybody is a kind of self-empowerment exercise. Everybody can do that. Yes, let's do that. And this was, this idea of, everybody can make a sticker and stick it on the wall. But the signature of the statement is not irrelevant. It's hardly relevant. We know what happened with Banksy, right? So it's anonymity and stardom. This is a paradoxical relationship. A larger number of cultural producers and urban cultural producer, people acting on public space, is nowadays around than it was in the early 2000s. A lot of people are doing things, but this paradox only fostered the fame of fewer bigger names. So it created a stardom of the street art, right? A stardom of the graffiti thing. It's a very curious thing in which, you have more production, and because you have more production, you also have this gotha, you also have this... this is one thing. And then the other is, as I said, we ourselves were caught with our small local graffiti festival. We were caught into this larger movement towards graffiti events, right? Which is now big, and Philadelphia, a number of cities across Europe, street art festivals everywhere, basically, right? Street art fairs, street art festivals everywhere, to the point that, and I want to conclude by telling this curious story about visibility and invisibility and effacement. This is a famous Kreutzberg piece by Blue. I'm pretty sure you've seen it. It was drawn in, was made in 2007 with the collaboration of Gérard. Blue made the first version without the eyes, and then the eyes are by Gérard. But what happened is that just a year after, Blue was invited by the Tate Modern. And street art went big into the mainstream cultural institution. Nowadays, there are all contemporary art museums around the world have at least one piece of street art. It's not entire galleries of street art. And this is the same piece in a very strange context. It's really a steal from a promotional video of Victoria Öffe, real estate development agency. So they are really real estate developers, and they are trying to sell apartments in central Berlin on the Spree, and they are really selling, part of the value they are selling is Blue. Is Blue, is the famous businessman with the golden chains and the two gangs on the right side. It's very interesting. This is a video that should be very interesting to analyze because it looks like this. There is this maquette effect which you can also do with your Nikon or with Premiere if you're into video editing, and it makes the world looks like fake, right? It makes the world look like fake, and that's why the people who originally commissioned the piece decided to whitewash it or blackwash it. And this is how it looks like today, Kurvistrasse. It's very interesting story. This tell us that basically, you know, they were caught, as everybody of us is caught. And again, it's caught into a complex dynamics which nobody really masters, right? They thought they were the avant-garde oppositional, and Blue is certainly a very radical artist involved in the, you know, in the squat movements, and that is why after he went to the Tate Modern, he himself, you know, felt very badly about this mechanism of this street art business, and sort of retreated into doing more local things. And now you don't find his name any longer in those big street art festivals, certainly not at New Fest in Bristol or in the most fashionable things, or it was not in, for instance, in La Tour Paris 13, which has been the biggest street art event in the last few years. So you know, we are caught into strange, I would call, measure value complexes, measure value environments, and you know, the visibility of the public domain is also this thing that takes us somewhere and not always where we want to go, right? So this thing with graffiti is you know, the revolution is that nowadays, this is taken from La Repubblica, second national newspaper, nowadays cities legalize graffiti writers or graffers, right? So and this is a street art tour in Lisbon which you can take, and there are similar tours everywhere, and you know, it's ingrained, it's increasingly ingrained. That this is another example, very different cases, but just wanted to show you. This is l'Atlas Paris Mégapole. So it's a really a brochure for, you know, selling the city of Paris and presenting the city of Paris, and you know, you can see that the street you see there is Rue des Noyers in Belleville, and it no longer looks like that. But certainly this idea that graffiti and street art contribute to the vibe of the neighborhood has been pretty much bought. So one of the Banksy assumptions, which if you remember, was that they think nothing has right to exist. Famous right to the city, also echoes here. It's a very smart text, really. Unless it makes a profit, is no longer valid, because a lot of street artists are making profit, right, with this thing. And so as it generates, and not only artists, I mean, it's not to say that the artists are just sellout, right? It's to say that there is a whole circuit, a whole realignment of things around this that has created a completely new public domain in our cities, right? So it's neighborhood, it's people who run business there, it's the people who have shops, it's public administrators too, it's the real estate developers. So there's a plurality of actors that are around this realignment, and it's not just the three guys, the three types of people that Banksy used to talk about. But so it's very interesting to observe how in just a decade, you know, some of these circuits in the public domain can change dramatically. So I think I'll stop here, and we can have the break a little bit earlier. And yeah.
Yeah, we have finished perfectly in time, even in advance, so we can meet at in time at 11:30 to start the discussion.